The Planchet is a product of the American Numismatic Society. Become a member and support this podcast. Go to numismatics.org/membership. That is numismatics with an S dot O-R-G slash membership to see options and prices.
Silver and gold, silver and gold. Everyone wishes for silver and gold. How do you measure its worth?
Welcome, everyone, to The Planchet, the American Numismatic Society's podcast. I am Andrew Reinhardt, the Director of Publications for the ANS. And with me, I've got two guests, Drs. Peter Van Alphen and Udo Wartenberg. Peter is the chief curator here at the American Numismatic Society, and he focuses on ancient Greek coins and also has a vested interest in modern and contemporary medallic arts. He earned his PhD in 2002 in classical philology from the University of Texas at Austin. And Uda is currently a research curator here at the ANS as well, where she previously served as the executive director for 20 years. I was going to say 400 years, but that's not fair. You're executive director for 20 years. It might have felt like 400. I don't know. But she also specializes in ancient Greek coinage and was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, where she was awarded a doctorate in papyrology. And then from 1991 to 98, she was a curator of Greek coins at the British Museum in London and is a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries. Both Uda and Peter have published extensively in numismatics, too much to go into here for the time that we have, but their latest collaboration is what we're talking about today. It's a new book called White Gold, Studies in Early Electrum Coinage, and today we're going to talk about what electrum is, a little bit about the history of money, and about the White Gold project itself. So welcome, Peter and Uda.
Oh, glad to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you both. So we're talking about this project, White Gold Studies in Early Electrum Coinage. Can you tell me a little bit about the background of the project, how things got started?
It really started with the idea of our friend Chaim Gittler, who is the curator at the Israel Museum, who brought together a whole group of people that included our other friends that we had in this project. And that was Kathy Lober and Wolfgang Fischer-Bossert, who came in later. And the idea was to have, with Corey Connock's help, to set up, who was always interested in electrum coinage. He decided to do a big exhibition of a group of coins from the Kaplan and Thyssen Bornemisza collections. And this exhibition that opened in Jerusalem was called White Gold, Revealing the World's Earliest Coins. And there was a conference organized for this. And Peter and I participated along all the other various people. And we followed this up later with the second conference in New York. And then that was supposed to get published. And somehow, as so often, in particular with Peter, you ended up as one of the editors. So we took this on, and it's been, 2011 it started, it's 2020. It tells you a little bit about this story, doesn't it?
Took a little bit of time, yeah.
Yeah, so this is how this whole thing started. I think one of the interesting things was that we had specialists from a whole variety of areas that came together for the original conference. But once it became clear this would be a sort of major publication that would look at pretty much all electrum coinage sort of in the Greek world, so it included Cyzicus and Mytilene and so on, other people approached us. So we had some other authors that weren't originally in this conference. And so this is really what's so special about this book, is the comprehensive nature of you can read this from beginning to end. It's not like a normal conference proceeding and you get a sort of history about white gold or even gold actually from the very early period on, pretty much through Alexander the Great.
I'm not even sure if it was planned that way originally, that, you know, the call went out to a number of us to put together papers on early electrum coinage. And it just so happened, I think, that everybody's topics, sort of ultimately fit together, covering a whole range of approaches to this problem of early coinage, you know, from archaeological evidence to metallurgical evidence to, you know, larger contextual and economic evidence as well, too. So, you know, the final publication, you know, this white gold volume, which, you know, is 707 pages and weighs a whopping 8 pounds. I mean, it is a massive volume. You know, really does cover the whole spectrum of, you know, possible approaches to, you know, this problem of early coinage.
So with, first of all, for those of you who are international listeners, I will convert the pounds to kilograms. So we're looking at about 4 kilograms for this volume. So 8 pounds. Yeah, we have to do that. No, I'm joking, but with the, you know, we've talked about white gold, you know, we bandy this about, and you've mentioned electrum, and I'm willing to bet that there are some listeners out there who either don't know what white gold is or don't know what electrum is. So are these the same things? What are these terms describing?
Yeah, there's the white gold itself actually comes from a Greek term, you know, chrysion leukon, which appears in Herodotus. So Herodotus, of course, is the ancient Greek historian writing in the 5th century BC. And in one of the chapters in his history, you know, looking at the origin of the Persian Wars, he discusses the Lydian kings, you know, from the Mermnad dynasty, and particularly, you know, the final king Croesus, you know, as in riches Croesus. And Croesus had given a number of dedications to temples all over Asia Minor and elsewhere in the Greek world. And included among these dedications were these bars of what, you know, Herodotus calls white gold or chrysion leukon. And so, you know, we've been able to figure out, or at least, you know, philologists have been able to figure out that this, you know, this white gold, you know, which is the translation of the Greek term, you know, was electrum, you know, some sort of, alloy of gold and silver. And so that is, you know, what electrum, you know, is a alloy of gold and silver. You know, the question is, of course, whether or not this occurs naturally, and if it does occur naturally, whether or not this occurred naturally within, you know, the Lydian Empire, which, you know, basically comprises the western part of the modern, you know, Republic of Turkey, you know, from, you know, the Halys River towards the west. And at that point, too, the Mermnad dynasty encompassed a lot of Greek cities, including Ephesus and Miletus and some other very important early Asia Minor Greek cities.
Did electrum, was it just confined as far as, the, you know, sourcing the metal? Was it confined to the Greek East, to what is now Turkey, or did it come from other places as well? Can you find it, I don't know, in Asia, other places?
Yeah, Uta?
The real question that we have is, so white gold, and this is where I think we got to this whole problem, is this so-called electrum. If you open any book today, it could be the most general book on money or so, you will find a story how this was taken out of the river. And there is a sort of theory of a primitivist you know, story how this was taken out, and people weren't able to separate gold and silver, which of course is what happens later. And therefore, this is how these earliest coins were made. While this project began, there was parallel and almost independently these studies that were both in the ANS, but also in Paris and other places, where we looked at different questions, not just what's the metal composition, but also, can we see anything about this? Is this naturally a gold and silver mixture that comes out of a river? And one of the more interesting papers that came in later is by our colleague Kristin Kleber, who could show quite definitively that it was very easy to part by cementation, which is the process how gold and silver is divided. And this was, in fact, a technique that was already known in the third millennium. So really much, much, much earlier. And that the idea here is, as was always explained by other colleagues, that people just didn't know how to do this process. And this is why coins were made out of electrum. We're now beginning to move towards an idea that this was, in fact, deliberate, that the Lydians or a combination of the Lydians and the Greek chose this. And so this electrum is, in fact, all over all sorts of other earlier empires. We have objects. Once we have now much better access to metallurgy and can actually see how things, we know how they're made or what kind of gold, silver content or bronze they have, we realize that this electrum as also pure gold is much more prevalent than is used. So this is work in progress. This is one of the interesting things about this book. This is not the last word. We're working, you know, so to speak, on the second volume, although I'm not sure I quite put it like this.
Yeah, now, in fact, one of the theories, you know, behind the origin of electrum coinage and therefore coinage in general is that the Lydians in Sardis, you know, the capital of the Myrmid kingdom, had, you know, the Pactolus River running right by the city, and the Pactolus started in the mountain range behind, which included Mount Tmolus, which famously has a lot of gold deposits in it. And, you know, the idea was that there was this natural electrum, this natural gold-silver alloy that was rolling off of Mount Tmolus in the Pactolus River. And like, you know, in the Sacramento River in 1847, you know, they discovered all of this electrum, you know, in the river, were panning it out. And then because they didn't have, presumably, the ability to separate the gold and silver, you know, they decided to try to monetize it by having, you know, essentially the state step in and saying, okay, look, we know that there's a great value differential between the gold and the silver. And throughout most of antiquity, this value differential was about 1 gold to 10 to 14 silver. So gold was about 10 times more valuable than gold was. And if you have this natural occurring mixture of it that you can't separate, then you really have a problem, you know, if you're trying to use this metal in transactions, which meant that you'd have to, you know, weigh it and then test the piece, you know, the nugget that you want to exchange with, you know, for the composition. And so this would really, really slow down transactions. So the idea was basically that the state would step in and would say, okay, look, we will monetize these nuggets by basically overvaluing them significantly, you know, like 15% to 20%, and that, you know, we will use our state authority to basically, you know, say this is what the value is and you all will accept it. And so, you know, that has been basically the running theory now for, you know, a generation or so about the origin of this. And, you know, what we've come to realize that if this is not you know, natural electrum, if this is pure gold, and that if they are making a man-made electrum, then we really have a problem with trying to explain why they are starting to produce coins in this man-made alloy rather than a natural alloy.
And the interesting thing, wasn't it also, was the it's sort of an interesting story how you're looking at the evidence, the archaeological evidence, and interpret it as you see it at a given time. The gold that had been pulled out in earlier excavations just for testing purposes during the Sardis excavations, when analyzed, was actually pure gold. And then the interpretation in the books that published it by, this is the book Croesus is Gold, which is a really great book, but basically said, oh, this must be one of the later purified pieces. This is not out of the river. But geologists then tell you, you know, most alluvial gold is in fact has very little silver in it. So, and this is one of the really fascinating thing about this whole project is that one has to constantly ask oneself, are we just looking at electrum as a problem or even coins, and we're just repeating what we're reading in books and then trying to come up with another interpretation? It's and we were constantly challenged, and we're still not quite sure whether, you know, what the next step is. So work in progress.
Let's back up just a little bit, because, you know, we were talking about the concept of electrum, and now both of you have mentioned coins, and we haven't really tied the two together. And so, Peter, it sounded like very much like you were defining what money is, especially, you know, something that's minted by the state with a capital S. And, you know, it seems to me that this first example of money, or very, very early example of coinage, was actually made of electrum. So is this the first example that we see of metal coins, and why electrum to start things off?
Oh boy.
you get it.
Now, in fact, one of the great things that came out of that very first conference that we had in Jerusalem was François de Calataille gave the keynote address, you know, to, or, you know, the big event that we had of, you know, for the opening of the exhibit. And he basically gave a very brief overview of the conference that we'd been having, you know, the previous 2 days. And he summarized all of this by saying that, you know, the last 2 days have been incredibly informative. We've learned a lot, but we are still confused. But now we are confused at a higher level. And that, I think, you know, really summarizes a lot of this. So there are two problems here. You know, I mean, one of the problems is why coinage, you know, to begin with. And that is also then related to the whole problem of what is money. And, you know, separate from, you know, the whole problem of early electric coinage has been a discussion that's been going on now for a generation, at least, about whether or not there was money before coinage. And back in 2004, there were a couple of books published basically simultaneously, one by Richard Seaford called Money in the Early Greek Mind, and the other by David Shapps called The Invention of Coinage and the Monetization of Ancient Greece. And both of these guys basically argued that there was no money before coinage. And therefore, the introduction of coinage was basically the introduction of money. And that is something that others like Jack Kroll and Michael Yursa, who Yursa works mostly on Babylonian tax documentation from, you know, the Iron Age, which basically is around the same period that we're discussing here. Both of them have looked at, you know, this other tradition of using cut up pieces of silver, which in German is called Hochsilber. And we know that in Babylonia and the Near East and possibly even in the Aegean, they were using Hochsilber long before coins were produced. And these guys have argued that, you know, that they were basically using Hochsilber as money. So, you know, there is that argument that, yes, there was money before coinage, and then the argument that, no, there was no money before coinage. But, you know, all of these guys are basically using a particular way of defining money, you know, a functionalist approach that looks at, you know, basically sort of a checklist of what money is and how you define it, you know, like unit of account, store value, medium of exchange, and so forth. And if these things, you know, if you can check off all this on the list, then yes, it's money. And, you know, that functionalist approach is a little bit problematic because, you know, Seaford, for example, expanded, you know, the usual checklist of 3 items or 4 items sometimes to 7 items. And so went down his checklist of 7 functions, you know, basically, and said, yes, well, you know, Hochsilber does say 4 out of 7, but not 7 out of 7, which is what coins do. So, you know, the debate goes on, and I've actually written about this. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago called Muddle Wrestling, Grappling for Conceptual Clarity in Archaic Money, you know, where I tried to, you know, look at sort of the approaches to this question and wondering if the approaches that we're taking, especially this functionalist approach, is correct, and whether or not we need to be a little bit less adhering to this functionalist approach and sort of more open-minded to the complexity that money is. I mean, money is a hugely complex problem. You know, it really depends on how you're defining money to begin with, and then whether or not coins are, you know, part of money. And so then, you know, if you can say then that, you know, there was money before coinage, that coins, you know, are introduced and are serving now sort of a different function than Hochsilber did before, then that then brings us also then to the question of why Electrum, you know, and that is also a complexity.
I have to say, this was always one of the really puzzling things, you know, why Electrum? And initially, this became with our metal analysis that we would do, which wasn't just looking how much gold and silver, but also looking at the surface, you know, with synchrotron and other sort of relatively sophisticated methodologies that are now available. And it seemed to become clear, and this is one of the lack in this book, that we have not been able to put all the metal analysis in it because that was still work in progress. But it becoming at least clear to me that this Electrum, in my view, and so some other people, is a deliberate choice. But then you think, well, so why then? This is even more bizarre. If you could do proper gold and silver, as happens then with Croesus, so why do this? And Alain Bresson, in really what is one of the most sort of really brilliant ideas in his article, you know, says this is basically a very deliberate choice, one of monometallism, as he calls it. So in, as opposed to bimetallism, which is, of course, a concept that we have throughout monetary history, also in the United States, very interesting that you have a exchange rate of gold to silver, which we know existed in this period. And by what then happens? So if, let's say they had picked gold, you know, then wherever the gold was needed, this coinage would have been removed. And so by creating a deliberate and probably quite clear gold-silver mixture that was valued at a certain point, this basically became a monometallic economy, and they were worth something, and they stayed there. And that's, of course, exactly the circulation pattern that we have. We have an enormous number of these electrum coins found in Western Turkey, and they don't seem to move until much, much later. And so this theory has a lot, is very, very attractive.
Yeah, no, it really is a brilliant idea, because he is trying to deal with basically the problems of bimetallism, you know, and these coins are bimetallic, you know, they're gold and silver. And so, you know, the traditional instability within bimetallic systems where you have, you know, either a silver standard or a gold standard, which means then that you are dealing with the instability in the, you know, valuation between these two metals, which can really screw up, you know, the production of coinage in one metal or the other, and the way that these are valued, you know, against each other, you know, in the marketplace particularly, which might not respect, you know, the denominated value that the, you know, the state is trying to impose on it. So, you know, by locking the two metals together inside a single object, you know, Bressano's argument that they were trying to create, you know, just inherent stability in the system, which is, you know, it's a great idea, but, you know, it also then raises a lot of questions, you know, about, okay, so we have stability in these, in the system, but then what about the valuation of these objects, you know, within the marketplace? And that you know, is where, you know, Veld's paper, François Veld's paper in this volume really is quite interesting as well, too, because he was able to deduce from, you know, looking at a number of different sources, you know, what the value of some of these coins may have been, you know, the transactional value within in the marketplace, and they were hugely valuable. You know, so the very smallest of these coins, either 1/96th or 1/192nd, if some of these coins are that small, these things, you know, weigh a tenth of a gram, you know, would have had the transactional value of roughly 2 days' wages, which means then that the largest coins, you know, the staters, you know, would have had a transactional value of about 6 months' wages. And if you want to like convert that into dollar amounts, you're looking at a large coin that has, let's say, transactional value of like $30,000 to $40,000, and the smallest one, you know, of around $100. You know, I mean, these are not coins you're going to be taking to the bodega to buy a pack of gum with, for example, the little small ones.
Peter and Uta, we're talking about, you know, the size of these coins, the weights of these coins. And for those people who are listening who don't know, you know, how big an electrum coin is, can you give them an idea? And when you said a 92nd or a 96, what exactly does that mean?
But it's a sort of point of a needle, isn't it? I mean, it is literally as small if we drop them in our vault. We have to get a loop to find them. And you know, this also brings up the question, how was this used?
Right.
It's not that you know, open your wallet and say, ah, this is a 96 and this is a 48. And so the question is really how weight and other things come into it. One of the things, though, that is clear is the sheer number in this database project that I'm doing with Wolfgang Fischer-Bossert, where we're trying to collect every single electrum coin that has ever been gone into museum, private collection, or on the market in auction catalogs, where we have probably over 10,000 of them, of this earlier group, excluding Kizikus and all this, 10,000 found. This is an enormous number and actually shows the popularity of that medium of exchange in the 7th and then into throughout the 6th century. And, you know, so people, however it was used, the one thing is clear, people like that stuff.
And one of the things too about this coinage, and you know, this is something else that Veld's chapter in the volume does, you know, really illustrate quite nicely, is that there was a broad range of denominations. So the largest denomination in all of these series is something we call the stater. And most of the coins that we are dealing with were produced on what we called the Lido Milesian standard, where the stater would be about 14.2 grams roughly. And then the division of that stater into various denominations, like a third, a sixth, a 12th, and so forth, would be, you know, dividing that stater weight by, you know, 3 or 6 or 12 or whatever. So by the time you get down to a 196, you're dividing, you know, 14.2 grams by 96, and you're getting something that, you know, weighs roughly a tenth of a gram. And these coins are just minuscule. So, you know, the functionality, I mean, the actual functionality of these coins, you know, even though you've got this broad denominational range, which presumably is to cover a whole broad range of transactions, you know, if these coins are so incredibly valuable that, you know, even the smallest one is worth 2 days' wages, then what are the transactions that these people are using these coins for?
Right. And also the other thing is when you look at the surviving coins, and this is something I'm working on at the moment, is to see what type of coins are there. When you open, you know, a standard book, what you see is like these nice staters, or you see maybe a Lydian treaty. But actually, most of the coins in the database, or most surviving coins, are around 1 gram or less. So there is the small denominations that is where the mass is, the sheer mass. And but if we look at this, you know, when this is one of the things where the wealth of Ionia in that period, when we look at this and the archaeological material is very clear there, we look at Ephesus, we look at Sardis and so on, it all gets destroyed by the Persians later on. But an enormous number of people were brought in to build whatever, you know, and the idea this was all done maybe with slaves, I think, is probably rather misguided, because we can see from many of the documents that people are brought in, you know, specialist stonemasons and people like this. So the idea really that, you know, this was a sort of rural economy where people, you know, would go to the market or so. No, I mean, there's a lot of specialists in the Lydian Empire in particular, with this incredible wealth, that probably were paid and were using this material. I think that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, I agree. You know, again, it raises a lot of questions about, you know, what sort of transactions. And, you know, that there is a document which is discussed by both Jack Kroll and Alain Bresson in their chapters in the volume. This is a document that was found in the excavations at Ephesus, and it's basically a sheet of lead or silver. I mean, it's still a little bit open to question, you know, what the actual composition of this thing is. But, you know, there are several lines written in Greek on this that seem to record payments of some sort of tax or you know, tribute or something to the temple, it would seem. You know, that there was a major temple of Artemis in Ephesus there. And the rates, or it's not the rates, but it's the amounts of both items in kind, but also weights of gold and silver, you know, being paid in, that are, especially the gold and silver, that's really quite interesting. And this document dates to roughly 570 BC, based on the letter forms and so forth. And it's quite clear that the gold and silver being paid in is pure gold and pure silver, but not electrum. And the fact that this dates to the period when electrum coinage is being produced and circulating quite broadly, you know, within that whole area, the emission of electrum, and especially electrum coinage, really raises a lot of questions. And, you know, one of the questions that, you know, both of them raise is whether or not electrum would have been, electrum coinage would have been permissible as payments in taxes to the temple. And if not, and if, you know, if the temple is only wanting to receive pure gold and pure silver, then this also raises questions about, you know, what sort of transactions the electrum coinage, you know, would have been permissible to be, you know, used for. So, you know, again, you know, we seem to have a coinage that has a very, very high value, you know, across the board, even, you know, the smallest, even though, you know, they're minted in large denominations. or a broad spectrum of denominations. But if, you know, Bresson and Kroll are correct about, you know, say the temples not, or at least that temple at Ephesus, not willing, being willing to take electrum coinage as payments, you know, for taxes or, you know, whatever, then, you know, again, it sort of restricts the use potentially of what these coins could have been used for.
We'll be back after this quick message from the American Numismatic Society.
The Planchet is a product of the American Numismatic Society. The best way to support this podcast is join as a member. Since 1858, we have cultivated a community of scholars, artists, collectors, and amateur enthusiasts interested in numismatics and the tangible history these objects describe. Go to numismatics.org/membership. That is numismatics with an S .org/membership to see options and prices.
The interesting thing is also, isn't it, the value is there, but when you think about the sheer production cost of this, so first you have to create your flans, which means you have to get your gold and silver, you probably add a little bronze to it, you then create these flans. And one of the most extraordinary things about these coins is their very, very precise weight. So we can be relatively sure of these denominations. And then they're stamped with an obverse in a, probably in an anvil, and then sometimes with one or two or even three little stamps. This is not exactly straightforward. So a lot of effort goes into this to create this medium right at the beginning. I think the revolutionary aspect of this is, in my view, because of this, is really much larger than when we were discussing the hack silver. It's not that the hack silver disappears. It's a bit like today. You have different kinds of money. But this one was really one they cared about. They engraved them, and there's this connection to gems, you know, how similar the designs are, or even these very odd designs, or the lack of a design, or just a geometric design. And it didn't seem to matter at the beginning, except in one or two cases, like with the Lydians, you know, where we have the Lydian line with the little, that famous wart on the nose. But otherwise, you have an enormous variety, hundreds of designs, and people seem to know how to deal with this.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the really amazing things that's come out of that project that you and Wolfgang have been working on, is you know, documenting how many hundreds of different types or series of these coins there were. Previously, that there was, you know, recognized that there was at least, you know, say 250, maybe 300, and you guys now have identified over 400. Isn't that correct?
Yes, it's counting. And one of the interesting things, though, is that what seems to be more and more, what are these authorities? There is a book that just appeared by a German scholar, Rudolf Hilbert, who did a dye study of the Milesian coinage. And in the context of this, he first started with what we all know is Milesian coins, and then he looked and he discovered that through the reverse punches that things actually connect that we didn't know connected. And this was also a small discovery I made with the so-called Ionian revolt status, where people always said, oh, they look so similar, but there is no dye link. Actually, there was a dye link, which suggests that maybe the authorities aren't quite as numerous as we always thought, and that they just changed the design. But one of the really challenging things is, and this is where this database comes in, is just you have to do endless dye studies to discover whether a obverse with two different designs is maybe linked through the one punch for two coins. So then we say, aha, at least they have to be mint connected here. And this is a real challenge, because these things are not easy to do, but absolutely fascinating. And it was one of these fields where just basic numismatic research of this sort of rather boring kind is just goes a long way, yeah. But it takes so long. And that's one of the reasons why probably nobody before us started, because right. These coins have always been around. But I remember looking at them when I was younger and I thought, no way I do this.
Now, in fact, that the whole problem of all these hundreds of different types and the relationship to authority or authorities, you know, is one that really fascinates me. And, you know, my mm-hmm. contribution to the volume, you know, looks at this problem. You know, and the problem really there is that if you have hundreds of different types, but we only, you know, recognize maybe 12, you know, give or take, city states and other, you know, authorities where you have, you know, some sort of government structure, usually a tyranny, that traditionally was assigned, you know, a coinage, you know, so like the tyrant of Ephesus or whatever would be responsible for producing this coinage. If you have hundreds of different types and only a dozen or so cities or a dozen or so authorities, and this raises a lot of questions then about who was responsible for this coinage. And, you know, the fact, too, that we have a really enigmatic series of coins with an inscription on it saying, I am this, the Sema, or the, you know, the seal of Phanes, also raises a lot of questions, because we don't really know who this character Phanes is. I mean, he doesn't exist in the historical record, you know, that we have, but he's responsible for producing a significant, you know, volume of coinage. And this is something that Wolfgang Fischer-Bozert in his chapter, you know, looks at. He does a dice study of the Phanes coinage in his contribution. So, you know, if we don't know who Phanes is, but somebody who clearly had the resources to produce coinage, and we have other series that may or may not be connected to other, you know, known authorities, then, you know, what is going on? And, you know, can we then say that the state, however we want to, you know, define the state at this point, you know, does have absolute authority or monopoly over the production of coinage? And, you know, my suggestion is that no, the state did not have total monopoly over the production of coinage. That monopoly was, or the monopolization of coin production, was basically a process that was starting to develop, you know, at this point.
Now, the interesting thing is, of course, what we tend to forget is if we look at the beginning of coinage, which again, maybe we can discuss it a little bit, but it starts in sort of 630s, maybe a little earlier, and then continues. All these coins without effectively any mint attribution per se, it doesn't say in most cases who made them or where they were made. And so we have almost close to 150 years of electrum coinage. So I always wonder, you know, our biggest challenge is really, which coin is 7th century? How do we recognize a coin from the early 6th century if our hoard evidence isn't there? And that's one of the really challenging things. And I've been focusing on the later end. So when gold and silver is introduced, we always learned, well, electrum kind of disappears. It turns out that's when it really takes off. We know this from hoard evidence. And in fact, you have coins that are made with some exactly same type in electrum and silver.
Yeah, that is something about your chapter that I find really fascinating. You know, my assumption always had been that when, you know, the Croesids were introduced. The Croesids are coins traditionally assigned to Croesus, you know, the final Myrmidon king, which were struck in pure gold and pure silver. So sometime towards the end of his reign, presumably, he abandoned the whole electrum project and just started producing coins in pure gold and pure silver for reasons, you know, we don't entirely know. And, you know, the idea traditionally has been that once, you know, these Croesids were introduced, that, you know, except for a few outliers like, you know, coins produced at Kizikis and Mytilene Phocaea, electrum production basically just stopped across the board. But, you know, what Utz has been able to show is that, you know, no, that wasn't the case. You know, electrum coin production continued, you know, well on through the end of the 6th century, you know, 50 years after, you know, Croesus gave up the throne, as it were, or at least was burned on his throne, you know, depending on... poor Croesus.
But it really is one of these, I look at it now, effectively, once these sort of independent, if you call them like this, electrum, basically what happens here, it's a very clear situation where Kizikos and then Lesbos take over this highly controlled production, which of course goes on to Alexander the Great. And so effectively what we have is a continuous tradition of electrum coinage, you know, from the 7th century until Alexander. And probably one of the reasons why it ends with Alexander is, of course, he opens up this enormous amount of gold and silver, in particular gold, which was before relatively rare in you know, that part of the world, in Greece and so on. And so then this need for electrum was probably not given, which again suggests, like what you had just said, you know, earlier, was some sort of state, maybe overvaluation, you know, that was always in place for this, and that people knew that's what you would get for an electrum coin. So didn't care that much what the composition really was. It was sort of fixed in some shape or form. But once you have all the gold, you know, of the East from Persia, you know, why bother with electrum? It's gone.
Yeah. Now, in fact, that is one of the curious things, too, about that later electrum, that electrum continuation, you know, into the 5th and 4th centuries with Cyzicus and Mytilenean Phocaea, that a few of the other chapters in the volume bring out. In fact, we've got three chapters in the volume on Cyzicene production, you know, the later Cyzicene production. And each one of the authors, you know, François de Caletai, Salini Soma, and our Polish colleague. Right. They each of them basically comes to a different conclusion about, you know, what the function of these coins were, which really underscores the fact that, you know, we don't fully understand why these electrum coins were being produced, you know, later on, which and one of the curious things about the Cyzicenes especially is that their circulation and use seems mostly confined to the Black Sea area, although, you know, they were also being used as sort of a store of wealth in the Aegean and so forth. But, you know, if these coins did have some sort of specialized function, you know, in the 5th and 4th century, then, you know, that might mean that they also had a specialized function in the 7th and 6th century, you know, towards the beginning of the whole electrum project.
It's a big mystery, this one.
We've been talking about, you know, the coins themselves, what they might have been used for, where they were used. And, you know, we've been dealing specifically with the objects. And these objects have got to come from somewhere. We're not just dealing, you know, with the metallurgy here, but also, or the historical documents, but we're also dealing with some aspects of archaeology. You know, we're tying these back to different sites. And I was wondering if we could turn a little bit towards understanding a little bit better what archaeology can tell us with electrum research.
One of the more impressive part of this book is our colleague Michael Kerschner, who initially produced an article on the electrum coins, and Corey Connock, his collaborator, republished for the first time the famous case of the coins from Ephesus, which is the largest recorded group of electrum coins anywhere to this date. But Michael wasn't completely happy with his introduction, because one of the really difficult problems we've had is that the archaeology, every time when these coins were found in 1904, 1905, later on they were published by Robinson, and there was kind of the find context that helped to date them. And they were dated to about sort of 640, 630 by the earlier scholars. And then when, you know, Peter, you and I went to university, we learned, in fact, that was all wrong. Martin Price and his whole group said, no, these coins are really much, much later. In fact, they're more like 610, even down to 600. So the beginning of early coinage had moved to 600.
Or even later.
Yeah, or even later. Yeah. It was depending who you believed. You know, there was Georges Leverdier and other people explaining this. And one of the key arguments of Martin Price, who was, as this article by Michael Kerschner shows, who really goes to the whole history, and this is why this article is so fascinating, that he wrote about how did this constant change come about? Because then what happened more recently, about 10 or 12, 15 years ago, an article appeared by one of his colleagues, and we were suddenly back to 630. The whole generation of Ephesus excavators that had dated this sort of around 600, and also the archaeological material, this was all wrong. And this is one of the more confusing parts that we were facing. And I think this book, the two chapters, which in fact go, I mean, article starts, I think the first article is 83 to 191, and then there is an enormous article of how many pages is it? It's like 90 pages. It's almost
each of them are small books themselves.
Small books themselves. But it is really the definitive word on the archaic temples in the Artemisium, and the question that were posed there. And this is really one of the dramatic improvements of the situations that we have now, really have a much better understanding of the situation.
Yeah, no, in fact, my understanding of what the central basis too. This is a structure within the Temple of Artemis, the Artemisium at Ephesus. And, you know, anytime you read about early electrum coinage, especially, you know, these early British excavations in the beginning of the 20th century, the central basis comes up constantly as you know, the fine spot for the pot hoard and, you know, various other coins. And trying to understand what this thing is in relationship to, you know, the rest of, you know, the temples. And, you know, there was a succession of temples that were built over the course of several hundred years, you know, on that spot. And how the central basis relates to that temple and that date and so forth was always just so confusing. And, you know, Kirshner does a brilliant job of just disassembling all of this and then, you know, reassembling it in a way that is completely comprehensible. And then also showing how the fine spots of, you know, the 100 or so coins, you know, found in and around the temple, you know, relate to each other and relate to the different levels and so forth. And so, you know, finally, for the first time in, you know, my life, you know, I've some, you know, understanding of what all of this is and the importance of this, especially for the dating, you know, and for, you know, being able to say, you know, pretty definitively that coinage, you know, began somewhere around the third quarter of the 7th century BC.
What was interesting also for this volume is that Ephesus is obviously the key in terms of where things are found. And then Gordion is another site. We have these coins have been in part been published and I think are being republished. But Bernard Weiser published from what I think is the only electrum coin so far found in Miletus in the sanctuary of Aphrodite, which is one of the striated coins. So there is here not as secure as one would wish the archaeological evidence, but nevertheless pointing again that this is a group of coins, these so-called striated coins. You will always read that we see that they're the earliest because they just have scratches on them. But there is something quite sophisticated about this. And the archaeological evidence really points towards a date more around 600 as opposed to a really let's say, Lydian or some other sort of date. And it really shows again that the sort of traditional approach that was already put in place on how electrum coinage was organized. It was basically, there were these lumps and then there were coins that had scratches on them and you could barely make out. And then it got ever more sophisticated. This is something that, again, with the spread of electrum coinage, what we can see from the sort of, let's say, not strictly archaeological evidence, because we know that coins are found in Caria, which is to the south, you know, of Ionia, but also to the north in the other areas, or even in northern Greece are fine spots that some of them look quite primitive, but we know from some of the dating contexts that, you know, through hoards or so, that these coins are anything but. So a simple design doesn't show this is an early coin, and this is where the archaeological evidence, as so often, really points us in the right direction.
Oh, you know, one other interesting thing about the archaeological finds from Ephesus, particularly that Kirshner also underscores, is that, you know, even though it seems that the temple, you know, as that tablet document seems to show, wasn't accepting electrum as a payment, you know, electrum coins are found, you know, within the temple complex, which, you know, raises questions about, you know, what are those coins doing there, obviously. And it seems, you know, from, you know, the fine spots and so forth, that, you know, many of these coins were put there as votive deposits, you know, so this, you know, either when the temple was being reconstructed, you know, and it was, you know, reconstructed several times during this period, you know, that as they began the reconstruction, they would essentially put this deposit, you know, as an offering to the god or goddess, in this case, Artemis. And many of these coins seem to be votive deposits, which is, you know, really interesting, actually, in terms of, you know, again, the functionality of these coins, where they're perfectly fine for votive deposits, you know, to give to Artemis, but they're not good to pay to the accountants, you know, of the temple itself, which is kind of curious.
Yes, this votive element is really interesting, in particular in the famous pot hoard, which is when you go to the British Museum, where the actual pot is today, and the coins remained in Turkey there in Istanbul, and Koray Konuk republished them. And the British Museum has just electrotypes of this material. Apart from one or two of the series, these are sort of designs with striated lines and, for example, roosters and other goats and so on. Many of these coins just do not exist otherwise in our numismatic records. So the only known example is in this pot hoard. And one really does wonder whether they were made, you know, specifically for some kind of purpose. I mean, so it's less monetary, but really a dedication. And the dedication aspect is really very clear also from the, or at least I think it's clear. I think there are people who disagreed with it, but with the other archaeological material, like this enormous amount of amber, decorated amber, which appears to be part of the goddesses, previous goddesses. There was probably a wooden statue of Xona on, and that had like a very fancy piece of cloth with this covered in this amber. And of course, amber being very, you know, sort of translucent, it must have looked something. And this was probably folded up. And again, when the new temple was built, put in place, and this is together with these coins. So it's like over 1,000 objects were excavated in that area that really show the importance of these deposits and these coins in for a single sanctuary that is excavated. And it's really, for those of the listeners who've actually been to Ephesus, normally it's one of the most disappointing part of the whole site is when you go to the Artemisium, because it's always underwater. Yeah. You just see this one column. It's a swamp. It's a swamp. In a particular dry summer a few years ago, I was there with Michael Kershner, and it actually was completely dry and they were able to excavate. But normally you have to pump everything out, and this has always held it back. These excavations, and so God knows how many more coins come out, because in most sites when there are excavations, the number of, let's say, electrum or gold coins is very, very small. In Ephesus, it isn't. So it truly shows the sort of very special status that the Temple of Artemis, of course, one of the seven wonders of the world, has already early on.
We've got a few minutes left in this episode. This time has really gone by quickly. You'd mentioned, additional excavation happening at the Artemisium of Ephesus. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit, both Uta and Peter, about where you see the future heading in the studies of electrum coinage.
I think a lot of that depends, in fact, on this project that Uta and Wolfgang have been working on. You know, this massive compilation of all existing electrum coins that they've been compiling into this huge database of, you know, roughly now 10,000 samples. You know, and being able to use that database then to conduct a whole bunch of dice studies, I think will, you know, help us answer some of the questions about, you know, the production of this coinage. You know, if you know, as Uta mentioned, we can see from, you know, links, particularly the reverse punches, you know, that were used, if say a single reverse punch was used for four or five or a half dozen different obverse types, you know, whether it was like a rooster or, you know, a seal or this or that, then, you know, that will tie together, you know, a lot of these series and, you know, might be able to give us some sort of internal chronological ordering, you know, perhaps of these coins, or at least, you know, being able to group them together a little bit more tightly, perhaps, you know, geographically. You know, so that I think is, you know, one direction, you know, that we can go, and especially with, you know, this project that they have been working on now for a number of years, which, you know, just has, you know, tremendous potential for, you know, shining light on some of these questions that we have.
I think the other direction is, as this volume really shows, there is a number of the metal analysis projects that began over the last sort of eight, nine years. And Nicholas Cahill and his colleagues in Sardis found a single coin find actually looked at the question, for example, of surface enrichment, which is one of these, how are these coins made? And I think one way how one can deal with the sheer mass of material is to look at the metal composition, because we're beginning to see a certain consistency, you know, of certain types that always have, and we've always known that, for example, Lydian coins have 55% gold plus or minus a little bit, and 45% silver and a little bit of copper and then other trace elements. But then we have completely different series with different things. And but just creating enormous numbers of tables with that look at these, and there are different methodologies. Our colleagues in Paris, again, is published with Frédéric Duras, had published the whole collection and here of Electrum coins. And so we are beginning to create a database effectively of metal composition where we can say, aha, if it's a coin that really doesn't fit in anywhere, I now look and say, okay, what kind of metal composition is this? Can we do this? And so the availability even of XRF, which is not the ideal because it's surface, but you can't cut these coins in half easily. No. And even laser ablation and all this, ultimately, all the methodologies we're using at the moment are on the surface, which is always a problem if you have any silver or content in it. But that is a direction I see a tremendous amount of potential in. And I think this is at the moment, from what I'm seeing, what's sort of in the pipeline, so to speak, is a number of publications, including most of the ANS coins that have been looked at. So just putting data out and making it available is, I think, the idea there.
Thank you very much. To talk about the current publication, it's once again is called White Gold Studies in Early Electrum Coinage, and that's edited by Peter van Alphen and Udo Wartenberg, with Wolfgang Fischer-Bosser, Chaim Gittler, Corey Koenig, and Kathy Lorber. It's a hardcover volume weighing 8 pounds or 4 kilograms, 707 text pages, black and white and color pictures, charts, maps, tables. There are 21 chapters divided into 4 parts about the Great Transformation, the earliest electrum and the evidence, the earliest electrum and interpretations and why coinage, and the electrum continuation. So thank you both for spending a delightful hour talking about this tiny money with great value. Is there anything else that you'd like to add here at the end?
Go and buy the book.
Yeah.
Go and buy the book. The volume is a co-publication between the American Numismatic Society and the Israel Museum Jerusalem, and is available through Casemate Publishing in North America and Oxbow Books for the rest of the world.
Silver and gold, everyone wishes for silver and gold. How do you measure its worth? Just by the pleasure it gives.